Funding for Think comes from SMU Master and Doctor of Liberal Studies programs.
You've seen the picture, probably hundreds of times. Six men atop a mound of rubble, raising the American flag on Iwo Jima in the heat of one of the most grueling battles of the Second World War. Half the men pictured died before the battle was won. The image inspired the statue at the Marine Corps War Memorial, and it earned a Pulitzer Prize for photographer Joe Rosenthal. This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. As brilliantly as it communicates the challenges of battle and the determination of the men fighting it, the very famous photograph leaves open the question of what happened when the war ended, when survivors on both sides limped home to rebuild their lives. And it leaves out what happened this past spring, when survivors from both sides had returned for a reunion of honor in the spirit of mutual respect and peace. Historian Dan King was there to witness it. He is featured in the new documentary Iwo Jima, From Combat to Comrades, which airs tonight on KERA Channel 13 television. Dan, welcome to Think.
Thank you for having me.
Iwo Jima was a pretty forbidding place before it was ever the site of battle. Can you describe the topography and the location for us?
Well, Iwo Jima is about 1,500 miles south of Tokyo. And before the war, there were about 1,000 people living there, just normal inhabitants. There were farmers and fishermen. They had schools. They even had baseball teams with the uniforms. It was a pretty peaceful, quiet place. Very green, very lush, with lots of farms.
What made it such an important target for U.S. forces?
Well, Iwo Jima sits directly south of Tokyo, and it's on the route to Tokyo from Guam and Saipan. Now, we stationed B-29 bombers on Guam and Saipan that we used to hit Japanese targets in Tokyo and Nagoya, Osaka, and other places. And the problem was is that Iwo Jima had a radar sight, and it could warn the homeland that we were on our way. So it gave Japanese coastal defenses and fighter defenses time to get up to our altitude and attack us. So if we could knock out their eyes, take out Iwo Jima, blind them, so to speak, then they wouldn't have as much advance warning that we were coming. The other aspect was that B-29 crews were getting hit over Japan proper with anti-aircraft fire and Japanese fighters, and they were trying to limp home to Guam and Saipan. It's a really long flight. I mean, really like 5-6 hours flight. And so many of them weren't making it home. They were ditching in the sea. And they were crashing. So Iwo Jima kind of became like a halfway house for these guys, where if they're missing an engine or two or they're leaking fuel, they could land on Iwo Jima, effect repairs, and then take off, head back to Guam, or wait for another ship to come pick them up.
And the Japanese had built landing strips there.
The Japanese had 2 landing strips on Iwo Jima, and they're working on a 3rd one. And throughout the battle, throughout the year before the battle started, the Japanese kept fixing and repairing their airfields because they wanted to use those to station their bombers to strike us on Guam and Saipan.
How had they fortified the island once the war began to defend those airfields and potentially strike at any Allied forces in the region?
Well, until about March 1944, the Japanese had largely just ignored Iwo Jima. In their mindset, they were advancing. They were attacking. Mm-hmm. You know, they struck us at Pearl Harbor and in the Philippines. So they weren't worried about a small little island. This actually in Tokyo proper. The address in Iwo Jima is Tokyo City. So they're thinking long range, far out, Midway, Wake Island, Pearl Harbor. And they're not worrying about trying to defend themselves because their mindset is always on the attack. Well, after the Doolittle Raid in 1942 and then the Midway debacle, the Japanese started thinking, wait, we're on the defensive. We've got to rebuild our internal wall here. And so they started looking at Iwo Jima, and they realized, like we did, this is a direct path to Tokyo from Guam and Saipan. And they knew Guam and Saipan had massive flat areas, were perfect for B-29 bombers. So in March 1944, they sent 5,000 guys to the island under the command of Captain Wachi. Captain Wachi was a spy who worked in the Mexican consulate before the war, and he helped relay information about the Pearl Harbor attack, the effects of the Pearl Harbor attack, back to the Japanese Navy. So he was a pretty sharp character, but he wasn't really a naval land force trained person. He was a bookworm. They sent him to Iwo Jima in March with 5,000 guys and a dozen or so huge 14-inch naval rifles that he placed around the island, and he thought, okay, nothing's going to happen here. This is the backwater. The Americans will never get this far. And he kind of just did his best And the Japanese military said, well, okay, we've got some guys there. This should be okay. Well, as the events progressed, they said, we're having trouble. I think the Marines are going to come this way. So they sent more and more Japanese sailors and soldiers to Iwo.
And this is a small island.
It's tiny. It's only 8 miles square. And there were, like I said, there was 1,000 people living there before the war, you know, kids and families, and they had a temple, and it was a peaceful, quiet place. And then 5,000 men show up, and there's problems with water. Very little rainwater falling on Iwo, and they collect it in these concrete cisterns. And then when you add 5,000 people, that puts a lot of strain on the island itself, the resources. And so the Japanese government was sending ships full of water and food and ammunition and concrete and nails and rebar to build up the island. Well, then in the summer of 1944, the U.S. Navy starts sending submarines and sinking these Japanese ships. And a lot of the supplies were not getting through. The weapons and the concrete and the beans and butter and things just aren't getting there. And so the Japanese keep reinforcing the island, and now there's 10,000 and 15,000. And soon there's almost 22,000 men on this tiny island that could support about 1,000 people comfortably. But now you've changed the whole dynamics of the island. And so this whole time, from the spring of 1944 up until the Marines land, February 19th, 1945, the Japanese are digging tunnels and bunkers, and they're digging in miles, miles of tunnels, interconnecting tunnels and bunkers. And there's a mindset that they're going to stop the Americans right on the beaches. One of the Japanese that was sent to Iwo as a defender is named Tsurugi Akikusa. He's a seaman first class. He was a radio man. Never issued a weapon. He was 17 years old when he landed on Iwo. And he looked around and he thought, oh, this is not a bad place. It's pretty. It's green. It's lush. They have fruit trees. The day he landed, there was a barrage. U.S. aircraft attacked the island and smashed his dreams. He spent the next almost a year on Iwo Jima until he was captured in May 1945.
We'll talk about his capture in a bit, but it's worth pointing out that he felt like, Akikusa felt like he didn't have any personal animosity toward the people he was told to fight. He was just trying to be a good soldier.
Yeah, Akikusa joined the Navy when he was 15 years old against his father's wishes. He wanted to be a Zero Fighter pilot. Well, his father pulled some strings and got him taken out of the aviation program and into the communication group. His father said, I want you to be in a safe area, assigned to a ship or a base back in the homelands. He was worried about his son. Unbeknownst to him, his son completes the training and gets sent to Iwo Jima, the worst place you could be sent to. And Akikusa said, many occasions, I didn't hate the Americans. I didn't know the Americans. My government told me that they were bad people and they were trying to take over all of Asia and they were going to enslave Japan if they ever won the war. So I was trying to do my best to keep that from happening. But he said, I never felt anger or hatred towards Americans. How could he? I didn't even know them.
Let's listen here to Woody Williams, who was a corporal in the U.S. Marine Corps during the Battle of Iwo Jima.
We were told that our freedom was threatened to be taken away. I want to join the Marine Corps to protect that freedom. And I never dreamed that I would go anywhere except in America. I thought everyone going in the military was to protect people from being able to invade America. I had no idea that we would be going someplace else and we would be the invader.
Sort of similar narratives between those two, at the time, young men on opposite sides of the war.
That's very true. You know, many of the Japanese veterans that I've talked to, I've interviewed 100 of them, Army and Navy vets, on their experiences. And universally, they say they were told the Americans were horrible people. They wanted to destroy the Japanese culture and enslave all of Asia. And that's what their government told them. And after the war, they realized, okay, the treaty is in place. The Americans land and they're bringing bread and building supplies and milk and chocolate and chewing gum, and they're not destroying the country. They're rebuilding Japan. And so many of them, people in their 90s in Japan, realized that they had been lied to during World War II, and they were doing their best to protect their country, but it didn't need protecting from the Americans. We came in, we rebuilt the country, and set Japan back on its feet on a peaceful road, which it still is on today.
So the U.S. ultimately would send about 70,000 men to fight at Iwo Jima. We should say that this was an important psychological target, even though it was kind of a remote backwater before the buildup of military assets there.
Yeah, there was about 70,000 sailors, soldiers, and Marines and airmen sent to fight in the battle for Iwo Jima on our side. The Japanese side had roughly 22,000 men, and many of those were second-line troops or older troops who were not really up to speed. So we had 18, 19-year-old Marines who just come out of boot camp, many who had been in previous battles, who were tough and hard and ready to go. On the Japanese side, many of their men were in their 30s or even early 40s. They had been recalled from reserve duty, like this man here, Corporal Abe. He had met his wife before the war. They got married. He got discharged. They had two daughters. And so they were living a happy life. And then in 1944, he gets recalled, sent to Iwo Jima. And his widow meets us on Iwo Jima each year, and she makes these little peace bells for us.
Hmm.
I'll let it you hear that.
And you've got a, yeah, it's just a little,
It's a little clamshell.
Trinket.
Mm-hmm. A clamshell, and it's covered with silk material from a kimono. She adds a bell and a little string, and she asks that you just attach it to your bag or your backpack or something, and it's supposed to give you good luck and keep you from harm and illness. And she said, because my husband was trying to protect our country, he did his best, and your men were trying to end the war and protect their country, and she holds no animosity towards us, and she realizes that the Marines and soldiers and sailors on the American side were doing what they thought was right. And so she lost her husband, raised her two kids by herself. But she holds no animosity or hatred towards us. But she has different feelings towards her own government. Hmm. She feels lied to the population. So she makes these for our Iwo Jima veterans every year by hand. She makes, this time she made about 400.
Wow.
So I brought one for you today.
Well, thank you. It seems as well like there was a sense among the Japanese, as much as they wanted to win this, that from the outset of this 36-day ground battle, they were all aware that the odds were astonishingly against them.
Yes. Yeah, all the Japanese veterans that I talked to who were in the battle for Iwo Jima, they knew from the get-go that they were digging their own tombs. Their officers would go around and they'd say, "Dig deep, you're digging your own grave. You're digging your own tombs." And when these men left the homeland, they left behind some hair clippings and some fingernail clippings with their families so that when their bodies didn't come back, that they could have a proper funeral, and they would burn the hair and the fingernail clippings in a Buddhist funeral rite. So they knew that they were not coming home. Countless postcards and letters that were sent to Japan had the phrase, "Do not expect me to return. This is my grave." And so the Japanese defenders like Akikusa and others had no hopes of returning home. And their job was to hold the Americans at Iwo Jima as long as they could to give those back in the homeland more time to prepare for the final battle that they were expecting. They didn't expect to win Iwo Jima. They were just hoping to slow us down, to hold us by the collar for even one more day to give those folks back home more time.
Because for a while, both sides were expecting there would be a ground invasion of mainland Japan.
Yes, definitely.
All right, we're speaking with historian Dan King, who specializes in the Pacific Theater of World War II. He's featured in the documentary Iwo Jima, From Combat to Comrades. It airs tonight on KERA Channel 13 television. If you'd like to be part of our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372, or you can email think@kera.org. Also, you can send me a tweet. I'm at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Graduate Liberal Studies Program. You can apply now for spring 2016 to design your own master's or doctoral degree at SMU, specializing in human rights, organizational dynamics, and more. Details at smu.edu/GLS.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with historian Dan King, who specializes in the Pacific Theater of World War II and is featured in the PBS documentary Iwo Jima, From Combat to Comrades. You can watch it tonight on KERA Channel 13 television. If you'd like to join the conversation, call 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. So this was a deliberate decision by Japanese commanders to allow 70,000 Americans to get to Iwo Jima without too much resistance initially. What was the thinking there?
Well, the Japanese commanders on Iwo Jima had a conflict between the Army and the Navy commanders. As the Navy wanted to destroy the Americans on the beaches, they wanted to build bunkers and have gun emplacements, and the traditional Japanese defense. When the Marines come ashore, you attack them on the waterline and destroy them there. Well, the Army commanders wanted to let the Marines inland and let them go into the tunnels and bunkers and kind of get entangled where the ship shelling and the bombers and the fighters really couldn't get involved. So they wanted to take away the Americans' superior firepower by letting the Marines land close and grabbing them by the lapel, so to speak. Well, in the end, the commander of the island was an Army general. And Kiribayashi, and he had final say. So the Japanese Navy and Army kind of worked on both defenses at the same time, but the lion's defenses of the concrete and the nails and the timber and the rebar went to the Army to build their bunkers and tunnels.
All right, I want to talk about the flag raising that so many people are aware of. First of all, there's sort of one mountain, Mount Suribachi, on one end of Iwo Jima mm-hmm. that kind of rises above, towers above the rest of the island. Why was that important to the Americans in terms of gaining control? It was hard to even get on top of it.
Yeah, Mount Suribachi is the highest point on the island, which kind of looks like an upside-down pipe if you look at it from the sea. And the Japanese, in fact, called Mount Suribachi Pipe Mountain. They called it Pipe Yama. They didn't call it Suribachi in conversation and maps. They called it Pipe Yama. So the Americans knew that we had to get to Suribachi because that's the highest point, and they have a view of the entire island. And it's psychologically, to raise your flag on the highest point is a big morale boost. And that morning on the February 23rd, when the flag went up, and the ships at sea and men were firing guns and horns going off and whistles, and it was a big celebration.
Now This is only five days in.
And in fact, Woody, on that same day, Woody Williams received, or he did actions that resulted in him receiving the Medal of Honor. He was a part of a demolition crew. They had TNT and flamethrowers and other things, blow things up and destroy things. Now his team was all killed or injured. And his lieutenant asked him, he said, Woody, can you do anything about those bunkers that are holding up our tanks? And Woody said, I'll try. He took a 70-pound flamethrower. He took four bodyguards, and the five of them crawled forward, advancing in front of the tanks. And they went and attacked the Japanese bunkers. For 4 hours, Woody went through tank after tank after tank of flamethrower fluid, went back to the beach, got it recharged, came up, attacked the next bunker. And it is a miracle that he survived, let alone that he took out seven bunkers, because they were designed to have interlocking fields of fire, like spider webs. So if you attack one on the left, the one in the center, and the one on the right can attack you from the side and behind. It's a miracle that he was able to do it. And he said, I was just doing my job. And I was trying to break through to save the lives of my friends. And in fact, two of the men who were protecting him lost their lives that day.
And of course, Woody Williams and his comrades did not expect the battle to last as long as it did.
When we got on board ship, not knowing where we were going, they brought out a board. And they had this thing that looked like a pork chop on it, drawn out, it lined out on it. And the briefer was telling us, this is where we're going to go. And it's called Iwo Jima. We'll probably be gone for about 5 days because the island is only 2.5 miles wide, 5 miles long. So everybody thought it was a piece of cake. A little 2.5 miles by 5 miles, well, you can walk across that in a day. You know, just walk. And I think that's what we thought we were going to do.
Instead, it was 36 days.
The official battle was 36 days, but the battle itself carried on for months afterwards. The Marine Corps phase of the battle ended at 36 days, but the U.S. Army, the 147th Infantry Regiment, 1st Battalion, came in to do the, quote, mopping up. They actually took three times as many POWs than the Marines did. And they took not as many losses as the Marines. But the battle for Iwo Jima wasn't really just 36 days. It went on through March, April, and into May. In fact, Mr. Akikusa and another man, Lieutenant Omogari, were both captured in mid-May. A lot of the Japanese that weren't killed in the pre-invasion bombing or in the battle are still in those caves and tunnels. They were sealed up when the Marines and Seabees closed up the tunnels with bulldozers. And these men were trapped, and they died. The Japanese estimate there's still about 8,000 men trapped inside Iwo Jima, and they're trying to recover them.
Their bodies is what you're saying.
Their bodies. They're dead, yes.
When Mr. Akikusa was captured, he talks about the fact that in Japanese culture, at least at the time, maybe still today, being a prisoner of war was not something that is considered tragic but honorable. It was like the worst possible thing you could do.
The Japanese soldiers and sailors were told that their life is lighter than a feather, a duty is heavier than a mountain, and that it's in their Senjin-kun, which is their code of conduct. And in the Senjin-kun, it says, you must not allow yourself to suffer the great shame of being captured alive. It will dirty your family name. And the Japanese culture, they trace their roots back hundreds and hundreds of years. And they have these little family crests that they'll put on their kimonos at when they get married to show this is my family lineage. And the family name in Japan is very, very important to keep clean and pure. And to become a POW would soil your family name and cause shame not only to your parents, but your wife, or your brothers and sisters, anyone related to you. So they were told to kill yourself. Being captured was called Saidai no Haji. The greatest shame, no greater shame, nothing worse you could do in Japanese society than to become a POW. So these Japanese soldiers and sailors, they find themselves trapped. They can't escape. They have no ability to fight back. Many of them didn't have any functioning weapons or they were out of ammo. They said, I can't allow myself to be captured. So they took their own lives, usually with hand grenades, or they would put their rifle barrels in their mouths and pull the trigger with their big toe. And Akikusa found himself in that same role. And he and his best friend were in this one tunnel, and his best friend took his life with a grenade. Akikusa had said, I just didn't want to die. I didn't want to.
He was very young.
He was 17. And he said, I didn't want to die. I wanted to go home, but I couldn't surrender. So he had been suffering dysentery for months, as all the Japanese defenders were. They were all sick and ill and undernourished. And he'd been injured. He had his fingers on his left hand blown off, and he had shrapnel damage all through his legs and torso. He was very sick. So he says his last memory is crawling past his dead friend's body towards a small opening in the cave. And what happened was a U.S. Army soldier with a war dog found Akikusa alive, and they pulled him out of the cave entrance and took him to the battalion first aid station, and eventually he found himself at Fort Eustis, Virginia. And Akikusa says that he thought the Marines and the U.S. Army soldiers wanted just to kill everyone and that they were horrible people. But in reality, he said, I was sick and I was injured and I was bleeding and this young American took mercy on me. He could have let his dog chew me up or he could have just put a bullet in my head and killed me right there. But he dragged me out and they fixed me up and they fed me. Treated me well because I was never beaten. I was never punched. He said, in my own army and navy, they punched me all the time. We got beaten and punched every single day. In fact, it's called Ippatsu Omimai. It's good morning to you. Punch in the face is called good morning to you. So he was just, his whole mindset was turned upside down. He said, these Americans are strong and they're courageous and they're brave, yet they're so merciful and kind. So he goes back to Japan after the war and he becomes an advocate. And he's telling people, you're wrong. The Americans are good people. I saw it firsthand.
And in the end, he was incredibly grateful to have had the chance to sort of go on and lead a normal life.
He He worked as an electrician, and he bought some property, and he still works part-time.
That is so very awesome.
He's a very sharp, intelligent, he's a very humble person, but he loves the USA, and he wants us to continue this peaceful relationship that we have. And he tells people in Japan, the Americans are good people. I know, I was there. And he's one of the last few Japanese who survived the battle for Iwo Jima. There are many that are still in Japan, but they will never talk about it. Hmm. And they've changed their names to the shame. Oh, in fact, when Akikusa was captured, the Americans gave him a document to sign. And you have your fingerprints on it and your photograph. And there's a line that says, I do not wish for my country to be informed of my status. He said, do not wish. I don't want my family to know that I've been captured because they'll be so ashamed. And if I click the do not wish, I can still kill myself later. Hmm. My parents will think I died honorably on Iwo Jima. So the battle ends, and it's, you know, April, end of April, and his mother learns of the fall of Iwo Jima, and all the family saying, we're so sorry your son's dead, because the Japanese army announces on the radio, NHK radio, everyone's dead. She says, nope, he's alive. I can feel it. He's alive. So her and her husband go to see a medium, like a soothsayer in Japan, and that person says, your son is alive. He's hiding in a cave in a hole somewhere. He's alive. So she's okay. So she holds on to that faith. Months go by. War ends. January 1946. He makes his way back to Japan. He's returned back. And he goes to the house, opens the door, and says hello to his family. He had never written to them, never communicated to them. They had no information that he was alive. And the mother said, I knew it. I know you're alive. His father said, your funeral's going on right now at the elementary school. You better get down there and tell them you're alive.
Right.
The town was having a joint funeral for 15 men and boys.
Like with his photograph or whatever.
Photograph. Mm-hmm. Yeah. They would have a long table, and there would be a photograph in black and white and an empty box covered in white silk that represented his cremated remains, because none of the men came back. Their bodies are all, you know, at sea or in China or other places. So he ran to the school, which he and I went to when I interviewed him a couple of years ago. And there in the gymnasium, they had 15 photographs lying out on this table and 15 symbolic remains. He walked up to the sound of Buddhist chanting and the smell of incense, the funeral incense. And he walked in, he looked around, and people thought, you know, seeing a ghost.
Yeah.
He quietly grabbed his photo and grabbed his box and sat in the back. And he said, I attended my own funeral.
Hmm.
He said, it's because the Americans rescued me. And people would say, what was it like being captured? He'll say, I wasn't captured on Iwo Jima. I was rescued from Iwo Jima.
Back to the Joe Rosenthal photograph that so many people know. There has been debate over the years. There are people who say that it was staged. There is a little bit more complicated story than what the photo itself would suggest. Can you kind of take us through that?
Well, there were two photographers on the top of Suribachi that day. They were Sergeant Gnaust and Joe Rosenthal, and they were both taking pictures and moving pictures at the exact same time. Now, for the average Marine down below, this wasn't a big deal. The flag had already gone up. This was a replacement flag. It was a little bigger, and there were some, you know, theories about the Secretary of the Navy wanted the first flag for himself, and this Marine captain said, no, I'm going to get it for myself, so they raised the second flag. So the second flag going up wasn't really a big deal. In fact, it went up quietly. There was no horns or whistles or shouting. It was just, oh, they put another one up, if anyone even noticed. But to the six men raising the flag, there's five Marines and a Navy corpsman, they were just putting up a larger flag. It wasn't a big deal to them. And the two men, Rosenthal and Gnaust, at the same time took their moving pictures and their photograph. And we're able to put them together, and you can see the exact moment where Rosenthal's photo was snapped in Gnaust's film. Sadly, Gnaust didn't survive the battle. He died shortly after that while going into a cave trying to find some Japanese soldiers.
As did half the men who were depicted.
Yes, half the men died in the battle, and many more were wounded. In fact, we had more casualties on Iwo Jima than the Japanese did. They lost close to 22,000 guys. Well, we lost less than 7,000 killed, but we had another 10,000 more wounded. And I'm not counting the psychological scars, you know, that we know now as PTSD, that these men carry with them. And we see that when we go to Iwo Jima each year. I've been 9 times. That was my 9th time this year with the Iwo Jima Association of America. Colonel Warren Weedhan has set up this association, along with military historical tours, to take veterans and their wives and children back to Iwo each year. And the Japanese let us go once a year for one day, during the daytime only. And these veterans, many of them, they struggle with going back to Iwo. And there's feelings of fear and doubt, and they don't sleep very well. And very few of them are excited about going back because they had those memories when they were young. And they have images of their friends dying and laying in the mud and the rain, and it's horrible. But when they go to Iwo Jima, they look around and they say, it's different. Something's changed. It's now a beautiful place. And we had one Navy corpsman with us named Danny Thomas. And after Iwo Jima, he was haunted by nightmares every night. He'd wake up with the smell of blood in his nose and taste of blood in his mouth from all the men he worked on. He had trouble with his marriage and jobs. He suffered. And he went back to Iwo Jima for the first time. And we flew back to Guam. And that next day, he said to the group, he said, I had the first good night's sleep of my life.
Wow.
The nightmares are gone. And he was tears streaming down his face.
Hmm.
And to see that when the veterans go back, there's this healing, the transformation. There's one Marine named John Skinner who went on this past trip. He passed away right after the trip. But you'll see him probably in the documentary. He's got his green uniform on. And he said to me, he said, Dan, I heard this Japanese fella going to be here that was in the battle. I don't know how I'm going to feel about that. And I said, well, you know, he's a good person, and he respects us a lot. He says, well, I just don't know if I want to shake his hand or even, you know, get close to him. I don't know. I always told myself if I saw one of them fellas, I'd punch him in the face. I said, well, don't do that, please. Let's not have that. Let's not do that. So we're on Iwo Jima, and after the joint ceremony we have where the Japanese and the Americans, you know, have this ceremony, I look over and I see PFC John Skinner shaking Akikusa's hand, and they're both smiling. And they can't understand each other, but there's that body language. And he says, he suffered just like I did. Hmm. We both suffered. And I thought that was a huge moment for me.
We're speaking this hour with historian Dan King, who specializes in the Pacific Theater of World War II and is featured in the PBS documentary Iwo Jima, From Combat to Comrades. You can see it tonight on KERA Channel 13 television. We'll resume our conversation in 2 minutes.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Graduate Liberal Studies Program. You can apply now for spring 2016 to design your own master's or doctoral degree at SMU, a customizable evening graduate program for working professionals. More at smu.edu/GLS.
It was such a pleasure to return the flag.
Thank you very much.
To meet somebody that was on the other side, I can't understand him, he can't understand me, but we can still be friends. And so I think I made a new friend today.
That was a scene from the documentary Iwo Jima, From Combat to Comrades, which, among other things, concerns the reunion of both American and Japanese troops on Iwo Jima 70 years after the battle. We're speaking this hour with historian Dan King, who is featured in the film. If you'd like to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372. How did the idea to bring these guys together come about? Because I know the Japanese government initially had a lot of reservations.
Yes, the Iwo Jima Association under Colonel Weedhan had been trying to get permission from the Japanese to go to Iwo Jima so these men could make their peace and have a ceremony. Well, when Lyndon Johnson returned the island to Japan, there was a clause in the treaty that said once a year, combatants could return to the island. So using that clause, they lobbied the Japanese government to allow us to take veterans back to Iwo Jima. We fly from the U.S. to Guam. We spend a couple of days there adjusting, you know, to the climate and everything. And then we fly to Iwo for the day. We land on the tarmac. We head out to a hangar. We load up in buses. And we head to the top of Mount Suribachi. The two groups basically stay apart until we have the joint reunion ceremony, which takes place on the actual invasion beach.
Hmm.
There's a large marker stone that has English on the seaside and Japanese on the mountainside. And it's a request for peace, where the Japanese families, and they believe their spirits can read the Japanese language from their side of the stone. And we have the English on our side of the stone. And wreaths are laid. And it's a time for the two groups, not just the actual veterans, but their families and relatives, to come together and declare openly, no more. No more war between us.
You have a little snack bag. What is in that?
Yes, I have here some actual Iwo Jima beach sand that I brought back from the trip. Hmm. Now, as a little anecdote, I was talking to one of the Japanese. This is for you.
Oh, thank you. And it's black.
It's pitch black.
Kind of chunky, not very soft sand.
No, it's not. It's volcanic ash is what it really is. And, you know, there's about 200 Japanese sailors that live on Iwo Jima. And every year when we fly there, you know, they kind of, you know, help us. They drive us around and they help us, you know, find our way. And I was talking to one of the sailors on the beach, the Japanese sailor, and he pointed to a lady who was filling a backpack full of sand. And we kind of jokingly said, there's no way she's going to lift that. You know, it was so heavy. But he says, by the way, I've been meaning to ask, why do you people take the sand off the island? And, you know, having lived in Japan for 10 years, I understand how they feel about superstition. Mm-hmm. They believe that an island that has so much pain and death and destruction, there's a negative energy that imbibes itself into the actual sand. So the Japanese, when they leave the island, they dust the sand off their feet. They're very careful not to take any with them because they don't want that negative energy, or many of them believe, spirits to follow them back to Japan and cause problems. And so he couldn't understand why we would actually take bags of it home. So I said, well, we both can agree that the sand is soaked with sweat and blood and tears. And he says, oh, yeah, that's why you don't want it. I said, that's why we want it. Hmm. And he cocked his head and I said, this is the blood, sweat, and tears of our dads, our grandfathers, our uncles, our brothers, our cousins. This is important to us to take home and share. And he's like, started bobbing his head and he smiled and he said, okay, I got it. So that was a nice aha moment, I think, for both of us to try to understand how important it is for the Americans to go to Iwo Jima every year and how important it is to continue that tradition of taking the veterans and their children back to Iwo Jima to see it firsthand. To read about it is one thing. To watch movies is one thing. But to actually walk on that shifting sand, heading up from the beach to see what the Marines did, just trying to climb it up is so steep, and your feet just dig in. It's almost like corn. It just envelops your feet when you walk up it. And these young guys had backpacks and rifles and helmets and water and food and ammo and grenades. They were weighed down, and people were shooting at them. So when you see Iwo Jima, you smell the sulfur, and you see how tiny this place is. You wonder how could they have packed that many people on this little island? It gives you a new respect for our veterans. The men like Woody Williams and like General Larry Snowden and Captain Yellen, the P-51 pilot you'll see in the documentary. You meet these men and you see Iwo Jima differently and you want to read about it and learn more. There's a tremendous amount of respect for the veterans, Army, Navy, and Marine Corps, that participated in that battle.
I forget who it was in the film, one of the Americans who says, the first time I came back and saw the beach, it looked really different. Like, I remember it as being so vast and open and there was no place to hide. And as it turns out, that, you know, the features of the land are a little bit different. But it just points out how terrifying it must have been for everyone involved, particularly for the Americans landing without fortifications existing previously.
Yeah, back then, there was no Kevlar vests. The Marines landed, but the only armor they had was a thin herringbone twill, HBT, shirt. And there's nowhere to hide on that wide, expansive beach. There were wrecked vehicles, wrecked jeeps, dead people, tanks rolling over people as they went ashore. Unfortunately, that happens. It was chaos. And the Marines were able to push through that, organize, and attack the island. It's just commendable. It's incredible what they did.
How important is it today to younger Japanese people to remember and honor the sacrifices of their unsuccessful, defeated World War II veterans?
It's something in Japan, they really don't teach World War II history. They have a lot of negative things that happened in World War II. We know there's the Bataan Death March. There's the Death Railway. in Thailand. Now, there's the Burma Railway and, of course, Nanking and the places, the atrocities that happened in Wake Island and other places where people did horrible, despicable, unforgivable things. And the Japanese have yet to really come to terms with how to deal with that. How do they show respect for the veterans that actually deserved it? There were, I would say, a vast majority of the Japanese veterans from World War II behaved properly with honor. There were, you know, pilots and airmen, submarine crews who did their duty, didn't do anything wrong to anyone. They followed the orders. But there was a smaller portion that did just unspeakable things. And the Japanese are having a hard time coming to grips. How do we honor and show respect to our veterans and yet deal with these issues that we can't really deny? Because the Philippines reminds us, Korea reminds us, China reminds us, and, you know,
understandably.
Yes, that horrible. And I've interviewed veterans who've told me personally, firsthand, things that they did in China and the Philippines that I'm going to write about in my book series. I've gotten these first two out, Last Zero Fighter and A Tomb Called Iwo Jima. But I've got several more that I'm writing. And the reason why I'm writing these books is to take what the average American can never get in knowledge as far as meeting a Japanese veteran. Because reading Japanese, writing it, speaking it is something that's not easy to acquire. You know, it took me a long time. So I wanted to interview these veterans, share their experiences. Like, everything is a two sides, right? A coin has two sides. And without saying the Japanese, you know, were justified at all, I'm just saying every story has two sides. Mm-hmm. And to better understand what happened at Iwo Jima, we have to hear firsthand what the Japanese experienced. And many of our American veterans, when they learn that their counterparts, their enemy, were starving, they were sick, they had no hope of getting off the island, they had no fresh food, they had no mail, they tend to look at them a little differently and sympathize more. One of the Japanese survivors told me, he said, "I have more in common with a Marine that tried to kill me than I do anybody in Japan today." Hmm. He said, "The Marines suffered like we did. The Marines didn't want to be there. They were scared and they were dying just like us. And the young people in Japan today don't understand any of that. And they have no appreciation and no gratitude and no respect for the freedoms they have." And that to me was very poignant, that a Japanese survivor had more in common and felt more kinship to an American Marine than he did to one of his own people.
Let's go to the phones now. We have Calvin on the line in Rockwall. Hi, Calvin.
I was just wondering. I heard him say that he had to lobby the Japanese government. And I remember when I was over there, we used to fly to Iwo Jima. We have Coast Guard station on Iwo Jima. And I was wondering why we had to lobby when we actually fly there, I think, once a week. We're resupplying all kinds of things. I was just wondering.
Yes, sir. The Japanese and the U.S. military, they have an agreement where they share the island. You know, we have a U.S. hangar on Iwo Jima, and fighter jets go there, and they do training. They do night training, landing exercises. But to bring civilians is a different matter. And the Japanese government did not want the liability of having 100, 200, 300 Americans let loose on the island. You know, having a couple of air crews on the island who are in the military is one thing, but you have 200-300 civilians, aging civilians in their 80s and 90s walking around, there's a huge liability. Like, medically, they're concerned, what do we do if someone gets sick and this and that happens, or someone, you know, dies? So the Iwo Jima Association has left all those hurdles and set up a procedure where everything is taken care of, where we have medical staff that go with us. And everything's timed and coordinated, and there's vehicles. So it's a very safe, secure visit. I think that's the difference where you have military and civilians going to Iwo Jima.
What are young Japanese taught about the bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki?
You know, when I lived in Japan, I often looked at the Japanese documentaries and news and TV shows. And I knew this young man who was in eighth grade. He was a relative of mine. And he was studying his history one day. And I said, "Hey, let me see. What are you studying there?" And he flipped it open. I said, "Where's the World War II section?" And he opened this book, and there was two pages and only two photos. And one photo was the A-bomb in Hiroshima. And one photo was the surrender ceremony on the Missouri, September 2nd. I said, "Hey, where's the rest of it?" He said, "What do you mean?" "You know, the part where you bombed Pearl Harbor?" He said, "Oh, come on. Nah, just quit joking. We didn't bomb Pearl Harbor." I was stunned. I said, yeah, you guys bombed Hawaii. And so he wouldn't believe me. He thought I was joking. So I asked his grandma, and I said, hey, grandma, tell him about Pearl Harbor. She said, yes, we attacked the Americans first, and that's why my brother was killed on Guadalcanal. And there's a photo, black and white photo of this Japanese soldier next to the TV that the kid had been looking at, you know, for his whole life and never made the connection. Never asked. And he said, well, we attacked the Americans. You know, they defended themselves. Young men like my brother had to go and fight, and almost all of them died. And the kid was just stunned. And that worried me, that the Japanese aren't teaching their young people about World War II and about such a tremendous event in their history. And I think that's happening here, too. I think we need to teach our kids what happened in World War II and the lessons learned and how important it is, you know, to seek peace. But not let ourselves become weak like it happened at Pearl Harbor. You know, we let our guard down. We became weak. We were compliant. We underestimated our enemy. The general understanding of the Japanese is what they were silk farmers and rice farmers, and they had poor eyesight and bad dental.
Poor eyesight.
Yeah, the image of the Japanese, the Coke bottle, you know, glasses, and they can't fly airplanes. And in fact, when Claire Chennault was a pilot with the Flying Tigers in China before the war broke out, and he sent reports back to Washington saying the Japanese had developed this mono-wing fighter. It's got aluminum frame, and it can fly, you know, 1,000 miles, and it has cannons in the wings, and it can outmaneuver anything we have. They were dismissed. They thought he was exaggerating, because there's no way those little Asians could produce such an incredible aircraft that we can't even make. So there's some kind of like a condescending attitude towards our enemy, which resulted, I think, in us letting our guard down at Pearl Harbor. And I think that's an important lesson. We always have to keep our guard up and protect our freedoms, and never, never let anything like that happen again.
Do you think we could benefit from bringing former enemies back together at other battle sites from other wars?
I think it's a great idea. I've seen Japanese and American veterans, the healing that takes place when they actually go to the battle site, and if they can meet each other and shake hands and share stories and share photographs, I think it changes people. I think the healing process is very important. And being able to bring your son or your daughter or your grandson to the island, it creates a bond, a family bond, and a feeling of respect, you know, towards these men who certainly deserve it.
Historian Dan King specializes in the Pacific Theater of World War II. He is featured in the new documentary Iwo Jima, From Combat to Comrades, which airs tonight on KERA Channel 13 television. Dan, thank you so much for making time for us.
Thank you very much.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is associate producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. I'm on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. The show's email address is think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.